Yoga Vashishtha, Part 16 by Swami Surya Devananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. The last time we discussed 1. The state of pure being, 2. Attain a quiet mind first, 3. Inner ascent, 4. Control of mind, 5. Cause and cure of samsara, 6. Avoid conceptualization, and 7. Relentless self-inquiry. Today, we begin with Chapter 6. Chapter 6 is broken up into two parts, Part 1 and Part 2. Together, these form the brunt or the larger portion of the whole entire scripture. Now, we're not going to cover a lot of things that are there in Chapter 6, but the main or centerpiece of the teachings comes down to the seven states or planes of wisdom. You may remember that we have lightly touched on this earlier in the ninth talk together. But today, we're going to start looking at these in greater detail, because it is here that Vashishtha takes up these seven again as a virtual roadmap for the spiritual seeker. Let us begin. Shubhicha, or noble wish, is the first of the seven states or planes of wisdom. Under this, we will cover awakening, renunciate, renunciation, behavior of the seeker, and focus of the renunciate. Greetings. Let us start with awakening, the first of 5 points that we have to discuss today. There are two types of awakening. One that comes about as a jolt, when things don't quite go as we would have wanted them to go, like them to go, or as we had planned. And the second that comes about by leading an examined life or a series of examined life. Let's go a little bit more in detail into this. The first awakening is a mere stirring. It's not really an awakening. It's like a passing shower. It comes quickly, it goes quickly, and we sort of do a take two on things or a relook at something and say, oh, and adjust ourselves in some manner, but not at a deeper level. And we are right back at the normal way of doing business. The second is like a lasting thunderstorm, the likes of which we had never seen before. And when this comes, we don't change anything on the outer as much, but there is an inner change of how we look at things, our values, etc. An inner change is real change. This awakening doesn't so much focus upon a different or a better way of doing something, but it focuses on being who we are, our understanding at the most fundamental level. This awakening lasts, it endures. It is not tied so much to the circumstance. The circumstance is a catalyst in the reaction, but change is inner, and therefore change is lasting. This, my friends, this wake-up call should not be taken lightly, because it is in these wake-up calls that we get to make major adjustments in our life. We don't usually make adjustments when the going is good or when things are as we would like them to be or status quo. But when things really don't go our way, we are forced to do a complete reevaluation, not of things as much, but about our own self. Our own evaluation changes from the notions we have to try and see things as they are again. It's a complete fresh take on what we see. So that is why this is very important. It comes about after living an examined life or a series of examined lives. And it is also called a spiritual awakening. A thought arises in our heart, not so much tied to the circumstance or situation, but on a much more fundamental and deeper level tied to being. See, there are changes or thoughts that are tied to circumstance. And as the circumstance passes, these thoughts leave us. But those that are tied to being are real awakening, because we cannot be separated from being. Circumstances can come and go, but being stays the same. And so this thought arises in the heart. Enough of this life and the samsara, or our normal status quo mode of living, which is devoid of any essence. And the person asks himself, why do I live like a fool? Let me look into these scriptures and teachings and listen to the wise men. This awakening does not come about easily, and it should not be taken lightly. This is a chance to really make an adjustment in being. Now, awakening takes time, but it takes time not because awakening and time are synonymous, but it takes time because we have to examine the unexamined. The unexamined notions in our life is what brings about all of the ways, normal ways that we deal with things, that our joy comes from things, our sorrow comes from things. Our joy doesn't come from things or whatever. Joy has nothing to do with people, circumstances, or things. But this is what we are habituated to, that if things go this way, if people are a certain way, or if these set of circumstances arise, I am happy. That joy is not going to last, because things are going to be just as they are going to be. They're not going to be how we prefer them. Think about how many people we have on this great planet. If every person wants it one way, can it ever happen? No, it can't. Things are going to go just the way they're going to go. And this is not fatalistic thinking, but this is reality. Does that mean that we give up all hope and give up on life? No. There's a difference in doing our best, and there's a difference in accepting things as they happen, as they unfold. Now, you may continue to do even better than you did earlier, but there's no reason to get disgruntled or to get unhappy or to get dissatisfied with things as they are. Things are as they are. What is the problem with accepting them? Accepting them gives you the strength to change. A non-acceptance does not allow you to change, because it's a grumbling and a murmuring. I don't like it that way. I don't approve of it this way. And there's a murmuring and grumbling, and there's a little sorrow felt. Already, we're not happy with things as they are. Now we increase the sorrow that we feel in our heart by an inner rejection of things as they are. See, my friends, you cannot change the outer, but there's no reason to bring sorrow to yourself with this rejection, because rejection and sorrow exist together. I don't like, I experience dislike, I experience sorrow. You cannot have an experience of dislike without the sorrow, grief, or even if you put it mildly, dissatisfaction that is associated with it. And dissatisfaction must and will bring grief. You can carry on doing things. You can change. You can do things in a different way, in a better way. But is there a need to be dissatisfied in order to do things? Can we not do things better by looking at things and saying, I'm going to try this. I'm going to do it this way. Why do we need to have dissatisfaction? Any change that comes about from dissatisfaction is not half as good as the change that comes about from wanting to do it better because you know you can do it better. That is a positive type of positive driven change. Change that is driven by a positive outlook. Change that is driven by a negative outlook is a change based on circumstance. And when circumstances are different, that change will level out. It will not come up again. It will not rise its head again. But change that is driven by a positive outlook. You can always have a positive outlook of things, even when they are going well. Can I do it better? Is there not a better way? And so that way will always be your companion, and it'll always look for a better way of doing things without thinking of what's in it for me, or without it being driven by events that have happened or things that did not go your way. So these are two totally different things. And the awakening that comes from the first, dissatisfaction, does not last, because dissatisfaction cannot bring satisfaction. Dissatisfaction can only bring status quo. This is very important to remember. It can bring about a level of complacency where we are calm till the next storm. But when we want total satisfaction, we will keep going from one to another, just like climbing stairs until the summit is reached. So, awakening takes time because we have grown used to a small little burst of, oh, it's okay now, and then we get complacent again. But to bring about this deeper, it must be better. There must be a better way. This takes time because we are not used to it. We are used to complacency. We are used to habit. We are used to status quo. But we are not used to change all the time. We have to change till we change our nature out of conditioning. And that is the bottom line. See, my friends, joy that comes about from being. Joy doesn't come about from anything else. And when we do things well, because it can be done well, because it should be done well, and on its own merit, we experience fullness of being, because the doing is tied to being. When the doing is tied to a circumstance, a condition, a job, a task, or something like that, it's going to go up and down, and we're going to experience the sorrows and joys that come from it. So this is a big change that comes about, an awakening. When we evaluate things, we have a change, we have a chance, an opportunity to bring about fundamental change. Because through things as they are, we are actually looking into our own soul. We're actually looking in the depth of our being, where understanding has made errors, and we have a chance to calibrate that understanding. When this fact resonates in one's heart, we have an opportunity to wake up and live an examined life. To seize that opportunity of waking up is to awaken. And this is the awakening that Vasishtha is talking about. We now come to the second point for the day, renunciate. So awakening is a mere stirring unless it's followed through by real action. Just as when we wake up from sleep, if that little stirring is not followed by a real action or putting the feet on the ground and standing up, it doesn't amount to much. So this awakening or action that we are talking about is to set our sights on the higher. And this is at once a letting go of habitual or that which is not conducive to our aspiration. See, my friends, it's just like waking up from sleep. When you put your feet on the ground and stand up, the standing up, the putting the feet on the ground and standing up is at once leaving your bed. You don't have to struggle with leaving your bed if you concentrate and if you want to put your feet on the ground and stand up. You simply want to do this and you leave this one behind. The whole struggle and change, my friends, in leaving things behind is not standing up. This is what it comes down to at a very fundamental level. People are in their bed and the blanket feels so nice and so warm, doesn't it? And things feel good because we are used to it. But things feel even better when you get up because you have a chance to do something. Put your feet on the ground and stand up. That putting your feet on the ground and standing up is at once leaving your bed. You don't have to struggle with leaving your bed. You just have to do this. When you do this or stand up, you leave your bed. It is as simple as that. And this is what the renunciate sets himself to do. To renounce, to leave the habitual ways and to take up ways that are better suited or conducive to his aspiration. He stands up. He wakes up, and his waking up and standing up is at once leaving the old ways. This standing up, when the person stands up, he is a renunciate. He has stood up, he has left his bed. When you stand up and awaken in life, the next step has to be standing up. You cannot awaken and stay in bed because that is not an awakening. So this is where we actually put our heart and mind behind it. The action that we are talking about, my friends, is to set your sights on the higher and let go of that which is not conducive. It's a very natural letting go. You don't reject the bed or anything like that. You just know in the morning there's better things and there is a whole lot of things that you've set yourself to do. When you have this drive to do good things, you'll get up from your bed. But if you feel that my work is a drag, it's the same old grind, all of this, you might not have an incentive, but that's because one lacks clarity, not because of anything else. When you are determined to do good things, all the opportunity that waking up affords you, there's no problem with getting up, none at all. So it's a very natural letting go. People struggle with letting go, this idea of renunciate, but I have to give up these habits, but I have to give up all of this. They never think about what they are striving towards. They're always tied to the past. And this is why struggle comes into the heart. There's no remedy for this other than waking up. There is absolutely no remedy for this. Everything helps, but ultimately you have to wake up. Satsang helps, books help, study helps, all of that helps. But it doesn't help if you're going to still slumber. You have to wake up. So it's a very natural letting go. It's not repressive in our heart and mind because the mind and heart is intent on something new, something better. And something better is never a struggle. It's a struggle when you don't have that something better. And you have this bed, and you have the habitual ways, now we struggle. If there is struggle in our mind, it is because we haven't embraced the better. So this letting go is also a letting go of the craving and all this that we had. Craving is habitual. There's nothing else about it. We crave for habit. There is a habit that is formed. And we are actually not craving for the thing, but we are craving for habit because habit has momentum. Momentum has energy, and this energy is the power of craving. It is that energy that we have infused into it in the form of repetition or habit that itself is working against us. So getting over this habit is what makes it noble. That's why shubhichha is a noble wish. And all these things that we are discussing that come under shubhichha, this is what makes it noble, because we go against the grain of habit. One aspires for what is good and what is lasting. And this aspiration for what is good and what is lasting or enduring is called a noble wish. With this wish in our heart, letting go, my friends, is not a struggle, because you've got a baseline, a new baseline. I want what is good and I want what is enduring. When what you want, you've set your sights on something higher. I want that which is good and I want that which is enduring. Then it is not a struggle to let go of all the things that don't meet that standard. But this standard has to be very clear in our heart and mind. We have to have that emblazoned in our heart. Then letting go, my friends, is not a struggle at all. Awakened or examined living is the way to come to this change of heart. You cannot come to this change of heart by anything else except living an examined life, where you examine everything and you see that things are quite different from your habitual evaluation of them. It is then that you don't rely on habit. It is then that you don't strengthen habit. It is then that you don't create habit. It is then that you learn to go beyond habit and go into awakened living. And this is a source of great joy. It is not, letting go of habit is not grief, my friends. Habit cannot do anything good for you, because habit is based on the past and the present is ever fresh. How can the past deal with the present? Tell me one habit that is based in the present. It isn't, because it's fresh. It's new, it's ever changing. It's changing from moment to moment. It is what it is, not what it was or what I'd like it to be. Habit is what it was or what I would like it to be. So there's a difference, my friend. There's no struggle in this when there is an awakening. We have all already covered the big difference between simple joys that come about naturally and craving for joys and pleasure. So this craving for joys and pleasure, it was this way and it was good and I sort of hope it'll be this way again. So that is a craving. It is that craving that actually drives us to do things habitually. Craving is at the root of it, wanting at the root of it. Vashishtha says, when such a wish is preceded by the absence of craving for pleasure, and you can put joy out there just as well, it is called a noble wish or shubhichha, and he, the person, is called a renunciate. So we're very clear about what renunciation means. Renunciation is not just giving up your pair of jeans and t-shirt and putting on something different and saying, well, okay, I'm a renunciate and I've taken a vow, but the mind is working the same old way. It's the same old things going on with a different outside, with a different makeup, a different getup. Nothing changes. Renunciation is a true and meaningful change of heart. Such a change of heart that habit itself is renounced. When one sees all my sorrows, all my joys, sorrows, ups and downs of life are not only the result of habit, but they are an extension, they are habit itself functioning in my life, then it becomes very clear to let habit go. And how do you let habit go? By becoming non-habitual. And what is non-habitual? It is by dealing with things as they are when they occur. And when you deal with that, you let go of habit. This letting go not only of one habit, but of habitualness, if we can call it that word. Habitualness is renunciation, is a renunciate. One who has that power to let that go is called a renunciate. And there is no loss in letting go, because letting go of the habitual is at once embracing things as they are, as they happen, fresh. It is a gain and not a loss, contrary to what you may, the common feeling about it may be. It is the giving up of craving that makes this noble. Craving for the habitual is at the root of a lot of our sorrows. And giving up of this, because of the strong force and pull, why does it have such a strong force and pull? Because it's us, it's our own energy. We are working against our own selves. And this is why in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you are your own worst enemy and you are your own best friend. Lift yourself by the self, and so much more. Beautiful teachings. And so this giving up of craving is lifting yourself by the self. It is something that each one of us would have to do. This craving disallows peace, inner balance, and calm. And these three things are needed for self-inquiry. We are not just doing this for without a purpose, but our sights are set on a goal, self-inquiry. I must know who I am. You know, my friends, we call this the information age, because there's so much data out there, but there's no real information. Information is about that which is inside. We must know that which is inside, which is our true nature. I must know who I am. All I do is a window to my own soul, to my own heart, and it gives me a chance to let go of that which is not conducive until this clarity comes about. And what is this clarity? What is the state that must come about for self-inquiry? Three things: peace, inner balance, and calm. With these three things, when the mind becomes calm, then it can look into its own nature. Just like when you have a pond or a river that is calm on its surface, you can see below and you can see the bottom. But you cannot see the bottom when it is all stirred up and when the waters are turbulent or choppy on the, or disturbed on the surface. So it is the very same thing. What we have been talking about, and now in renunciate, he lets go of certain things so the stability or inner balance comes about, so self-inquiry can begin. Okay, we've talked about renunciate, the one who comes to that state. Now we must talk about the third topic for the day, renunciation. Giving up craving, one finds a way to give up other ties too. It is these ties that bind, that disallow us from knowing ourselves, knowing our true nature. So all of these are given up when we give up craving. It is not so much the craving for this or the craving for that, but craving itself has to be given up. Craving is a wanting for something deeply, because there is a feeling that our happiness is tied to it. Our happiness comes when this comes. Happiness and joy are not tied to things, people, or conditions. They are the true nature of yourself. And as long as you have cravings, you will never experience happiness, because you have just tied this joy with it, which is within yourself, to something that must, a condition that must come about outwardly. Now, things outwardly don't always happen as we would like them or as we would prefer them. And therefore, Our joy is disallowed by our own breaks, by our own barriers. This has to be seen very, very clearly. And when we let this go, the mind attains to its natural state of balance or equipoise. The seeker delights in this peace and calm. This peace and calm is not something new. It has always been there. When you stop stirring the water, the bottom can be seen. When you stop this agitation, the joy of your true nature rises to the surface. It's not very different from that. It is then that the seeker asks himself even further, what shall I do to cultivate dispassion and cross this mire of samsara? Dispassion, my friends, is not a disdain or a hatred for things as they are. A dispassion is not being slave to habit, not being pulled by habit. That's all. And habit is what takes you to grief. All grief, all sorrow is the result of habit. Getting tied to habit, getting anchored to habit. Sorrow is not caused, it is not caused by anything outside, because it is experienced within. It is caused by confusion within. So, this dispassion is a sort of distancing from our passion and a focus on things as they are to try and go beyond them. Dispassion, again, is not disdain. It is not hatred, but letting go of these unexamined passions for the habitual. Contrary to popular belief, my friends, dispassion does not bring about a sort of plain Jane, monotone person. Okay, I'm going to give up all this and go to a monastery or go someplace and dress in white or orange or whatever be the uniform of the day and have my bowl of soup. And then dispassion is not that. Dispassion is not all that. You may have to do some of that, or you may end up doing something different, but it's not all of that. Dispassion is a feeling that comes about where one is not driven by existing, deeply rooted existing passion in the heart. It is that which brings about sorrow. When one is deeply anchored to that and things outside don't correspond with this deep passion that one has inside with habit, the state that comes about is sorrow. All sorrow is self-invited, self-sustained. There's no sorrow that comes about by anything else. Let things be as they are. Why do I have a problem with it? That is the question. This doesn't mean that I won't do things to improve every step of the way. I will. But what has dissatisfaction to do with it? Any action, I'm dissatisfied, so I'll do this. Whatever action is based on dissatisfaction cannot really bring about change. Why do we need dissatisfaction to bring change? Why cannot change come about without dissatisfaction? Change on its own merit, because it can be better, because it should be better, but not, it has nothing to do that I'm not satisfied with it and therefore I'm going to do this. That doing this is a result of dissatisfaction, which means that when you are satisfied with it, you don't try and do better. You don't try to raise the bar. And so you only do it a few times and you only achieve a little. But when you raise a bar in your own heart and always strive for the better, you learn how to do more and learn how to do better without dissatisfaction. Now we always have more, and we have done away with dissatisfaction, root and branch, bag and baggage. This is a complete change, fundamental change in our heart that Vasishtha is talking about. So this dispassion is full of joy, as one now has the inner capital. When you let go of all those passions, the energy that was in tied up into those likes and dislikes and preferences is once again made available to you to use to do things and change or improve things on their own merit. Not because I don't like, but because it can be better. It is as simple as that. You are not tied to habits change. The seeker rejoices in renunciation, and his attitude reflects in his behavior. Friends, the last word we just spoke was behavior. So now we come to the fourth point for today, the behavior of a renunciate. And through some of the teachings in this group, Vasishtha brings to front six basic points. We look at the points and try and look at what underlies these points, because how each one applies them is going to be different for each one's life. One, he avoids the snares of his own mental conditioning. This is a very beautiful thing. The snare, not of something else, when we usually talk about avoiding a pitfall or something, a bump on the road or something like that, that is there and I am here and I am avoiding that. It's a different thing. Avoiding the snare of our own mental conditioning means at once that you will lead an awakened life, that there will be unremitting and relentless vigilance. It is this vigilance itself. Unless this vigilance is there, one cannot see things or see this mental conditioning from moment to moment, real time, lifetime. So you avoid the snare of this. It's not just looking at that, being aware of our conditioning and at the same time being aware of things as they are, as they happen. And if you will remember, my friends, we spoke about this likely the last time. These two happen in the same field of view. What happens outside is known to me inside. What happens inside is also known to me inside. So they're both taking place in the same plane, and they should be able to be observed at the same time. People think, well, if I focus on the outside, how can I see the inside? We spoke about this last time, but it's so important to bring this up again. What is happening outside is known to me inside only, in my mind. What is happening in my mind is also happening in the same mind. And I am in that same place. Everything ultimately is happening in the same space. There is nothing else. And if it's happening in the same space, it's happening in the same substance. And if it can be known, that can be known either separately or this can be known separately. Since the separateness is not there because they are happening in the same plane or same substance, they can all be known together. This division is what keeps up this circus of the samsara. All this division is unexamined. So the seeker or the renunciate avoids the snare of his own mental conditioning. You avoid that not only by vigilance, but by living an awakened life, doing what needs to be done on its own merit, things that we have covered before, because it needs to be done, not because of I like it and what's in it for me. That is how we avoid the snare of our own mental conditioning. Two, let us come to the second point. There are six of them under this. He delights in beneficial actions instead of delighting in what's in it for me and the fruit of actions. And we are told this in the Bhagavad Gita also. Be concerned with your duty, with doing what needs to be done, not with the fruit of actions thereof. Can we do things because they need to be done? Why does everything have to have what's in it for me behind it? If everything has what's in it for me behind it, we will only do little. And we'll be little people. Though we may think it's big stuff, it's little. To do things because it needs to be done. And if it needs to be done, do it wholeheartedly so that it may benefit others. When we don't put things to our benefit and we put things that they are beneficial actions, period, because it will be of benefit, because it needs to be done. The sense of self expands. When everything is anchored to I, me, and mine, the sense of self contracts. So if we want this inner expansion, we have to break the ties that bind. And here is where Vasishtha gives us a golden nugget. He delights from doing beneficial actions. Ask yourself, my friends, at the end of the day, when you keep your spiritual diary or you do a little self-examination or introspection, what did I do? What were the beneficial actions that I did? Not because benefited was great benefit to me and I spent time doing this and I benefited this and my bank account went up and all of that. Bank account went up, the sense of self and understanding contracted. Great is the loss. Great is the loss. So this is something that we have to bring into our day-to-day life, a very practical thing. When you delight in beneficial actions, you can always do beneficial actions. And if your delight is tied to beneficial actions, since you always do something beneficial, you are always in a state of delight. These two have to be tied together. Usually, delight is tied to result, not to action. When delight is tied to doing things or an action that benefits me, and things don't always work out that way. So this whole paradigm is flawed. And if this is changed by broadening the druthers or the parameters, he delights in beneficial actions. Number three, in secret, he performs auspicious actions. And auspicious are good actions, good things. All the good that one does in life should be done without much fanfare. Swami Shivananda writes, the right hand should not know what the left is doing. As simple as that. When we do things and then again expect that there'll be some positive feedback from it, and that feedback doesn't come, there is disappointment. We did something good, and what comes as a result of disappointment. Look at how flawed this is, my friends, because of that silly little thing called expectation. And who put that there? We put it there. So who disallowed happiness? We disallowed our own happiness. Is that wise? You have to ask yourself all this. In secret, he performs auspicious actions, which means the right hand should not know what the left is doing. When you do something good, there should be no fanfare at all and no rejection at all. You pick up something in the street, you give up something, your seat to somebody or anything like that, and you do it because it needs to be done. As simple as that. There's no need for any big speech or nothing like that after that and try to exalt yourself or anything like that because it needs to be done. So this is what it means. Four, his actions are non-violent and they don't excite others. Now, it's very possible that if you do things, people might still consider them, or that they may still get excited by your action positively or negatively. But the whole focus on that is intent. Did you intend to aggravate people or put them on a high or put them on a low? If you are being true to yourself, you are doing things because it needs to be done, because your deepest understanding guides you towards this out there, and there is no intent at all of hurting people in any way. Violence is taken out of the equation. There is no intent to hurt at all. Violence is not so much the deed, but the intent. And to a small extent, my friends, you even see this in the law, where they try to understand the intent of the person before they talk about culpability. So intent comes in even there in a small way. But in spiritual life and in the law of karma, intent is the most important thing. So his actions are non-violent, not because of this, something happened. There was no intent to it at all in any way in the deepest recess of his heart. And because that is not there, there is no intent to excite others. If there is an excitement that comes about somehow, positively or negatively by others, it wasn't tied to the intent, it wasn't tied to your heart at all. So there is a cleanliness in our heart, a cleansing in our heart that comes about by this. Number five, he refrains from sin and the pursuit of pleasure, often misunderstood. He refrains from sin. And what is sin? Anything that does not bring about purity of heart. Anything that does not correspond with the teachings of the sages, with the teachings of great ones, the teachings of scriptures, the people that have gone before us that have realized the truth. That does not correspond with that. And to put it in an even more homely manner, that does not quite sit well with our heart. As simple as that. Now, the sin part we have touched upon lightly. Let us talk about the second part, the pursuit of pleasure. Again, we have talked about it last time, if you remember. There's nothing wrong with the simple pleasures that come about in our life. But the pursuit of pleasure is riddled or soaked with unhappiness, because pursuit is itself unhappiness. See, when you pursue someone, you run, you go out of breath. When you pursue something, there is unhappiness because you seek happiness. When you seek happiness and pursue happiness, it evades you because you're out of breath. You don't have it at that moment. It's like running for something and that something may not be there. Now you have the running which has left you out of breath. So this pursuit has to be given up. Let the pleasures and simple pleasures that come by in the normal course of your life. Do what needs to be done. Do your best and accept the rest. It doesn't mean that you give up anything in life and be less driven. But to be driven intelligently is one thing. To be driven habitually is quite another. This habitual driving doesn't get you any place except the wall. Intelligent driving, on the other hand, accomplishes a lot. His speech is friendly and appropriate to the occasion. And this is a very practical and good, wholesome piece of advice here. This speech, my friends, must not just limit it to verbal speech, but speech is everything. Today we communicate in so many different ways, through devices and so many other ways. And speech is also how we think in our mind. So we must get out from all of this. Speech, you can say, is all expression. All expression. All communication that starts with the heart. From that point on, and it may result in physical speaking or talking. It may be in the form of some message or email or anything of that kind. It may be any of that. It's all communication. So let's put speech and let's tie it more as communication. Even communication that is not communicated is communication, because the intent is there. And therefore, an impact on the mind and the heart and one's understanding is indelible. It is instant, real, lifetime, whether you outright say it or not, if that is how you feel in your heart. So, at the heart, if we keep a level of friendliness and appropriateness, friendliness, I think all of you can understand very clearly, come to your own conclusion. But let us spend a minute on this thing called appropriateness. Appropriateness is not always at that high level. Say there is a sorrow and there is a grief, or a person is experiencing sorrow. Now you may know, my friends, that things go one way and things don't go, they don't always happen. But at this moment that that person is experiencing it, there's no time for philosophizing maybe, because his grief may be deeper or her grief may be deeper. So at that moment, to have a little bit of compassion for their grief may not be a wholehearted agreement, and you're not a hypocrite, But you are sorrow that you are sorry that they are sorrowful. That is it. You know that things happen in life this way and that way. But we are not worried so much about the cause of all that sorrow. The fact is that a person is experiencing grief and sorrow, whatever be the reason. So instead of getting on a high philosophical horse, or instead of saying something or rejecting or whatever else, there is a moment of attunement with that person. And that could work wonders. And that appropriateness is what each person has to discover for themselves each moment, because it's fresh all the time. So, my friends, we are evolving on this whole thing of renunciation. And we now come to the fifth point that we have for the day, the focus of the renunciate. What is his or her deepest focus? There's a little acronym, focus of main effort, FOME, FOME. What is that person's FOME? One who aspires for the higher values or values the higher and respects those that have trodden before them on the path towards his attainment. There's a natural appreciation for the good and for all those that have trodden the good. And there's a natural feeling in the heart to want to serve them in thought, word, and deed. So this service may not always be a sort of physical service that we think as in servitude, but it may be in living out the teachings. If you have the teachings and you live out for them and you practice goodness in your heart as a practical living thing, that is also service rendered to the teaching and to the teacher. So there are many ways of rendering the service. He serves the holy ones, and you may serve the actual holy one. And people think, what has that servitude to do with my evolution in yoga, my evolution and my journey of life? Why should I have to serve these people? And you will understand, my friends, that serving the people that have trodden the path before you is also serving the attainment. When you value that, you also value the people that have achieved that. Because the people that have achieved that are not different from that anymore once they have achieved that. So since that is an abstract theme, the standard, the vision, all of that is an abstract theme, the person is a tangible person. The person and the ideal merge. The ideal is seen as a living accomplishment in the person, to the point where the ideal and the person who has achieved the ideal stand together, stand non-apart, stand as one. And so serving of one is serving of the other. This is a very simple thing that a lot of times you will also see that people, if they're having big functions or whatever, they invite a keynote speaker, someone that has achieved the things that they would like this audience to hear. Because what that person has achieved, they see as non-different from the person. The achievement and the person are the same thing. So people are all eager and anxious, and they sit to listen. And sometimes they pay a lot of money also to listen to the speaker. Why? Because the person and the achievement are seen as the same thing. And since the achievement is a sort of intangible thing, the person is tangible, real. The tangible and the intangible merge in that moment. So this is what we are talking about. A very important thing, and culture and society have changed so much that this idea of servitude or serving is almost has become repulsive. Why should I serve them? What have they done? All the stuff. My friends, I don't even want to get into that, because if that repulsive idea is there in one's heart, repulsion cannot bring about anything worthwhile. So that's the end of that. There's no reason to go beyond that plane, because it'll not accomplish anything at all. So this service, Service is a very important thing because when we serve those holy ones, we are also serving that which they have aspired for and achieved. We are ultimately serving our own aspiration only. These misconceptions have to be set aside because they are unexamined and they don't really mean much. So the deed, what they have accomplished, is very, very important. Now, let us get back into this thought, word, and deed and look at all these three together. One's thoughts has to reflect one's aspiration for it to strengthen. If one's thoughts and feelings don't reflect the aspiration, the inner marriage hasn't taken place, and it's going to be a struggle at best. If we want to remove struggle, there's only one recipe to remove struggle, my friends. One recipe to remove all struggle in any aspect of our life. It's called wholeheartedness. And sincerity and wholeheartedness are synonymous. They mean the same thing. So when people talk about the struggle in the spiritual life, it comes down to this: getting fully on board, sincerity, wholeheartedness. So initially, the seeker adopts a background of thought. This background of thought takes him to the next step. It's an evolving process. And then another background of thought. So whenever habitual thoughts come up or habitual promptings come up, there is an existing background of thought that becomes a sort of firewall. There's many different backgrounds of thought. It may be a mantra, it may be many different things. But this background of thought, it may be a mantra tied with an image that one keeps in their mind and it keeps repeating. This forms a sort of firewall that does not allow thought to break through. Thought and habit and prompting still rise. But in this firewall, they are seen, they are observed, and when they are observed, they are avoided. Because anything you observe is an object of your observation. The idea of subject or subjectivity retains, you retain subjectivity, and the thought always is object, and object cannot act out. For any impulse to act out in life, my friends, it must assume subjectivity, selfhood, or it must assume yourself. If you hold on to the idea of ourself, that I am repeating this mantra and I am doing this, and the I is there, this can never assume subjectivity, and habit can never act out, and they start weakening by disuse because they burn energy each time they rise and fall. It's quite simple. So, this background of thought is very, very important to take us to the next step. And it's an evolving process. This background of thought that one adopts, one may change or one may hold the same background of thought continually. But it's a sublime thought that reflects one's heart or change of heart. And this reflection acts as a firewall that does not allow habit to assume you and act out. Habit cannot act till it assumes selfhood, till it assumes you, till you and habit become one, and then it acts. Because only the I can act. And if habit is not allowed to become the I, and it is always seized as the other, because the I is repeating the mantra, or the I is doing one, any other way that one does it, habit is powerless to act, and it will weaken by disuse. Now let us get back to serving the holy ones with thought, word, and deed. Rendering full-hearted service is not easy, my friends, because the ego and habit interfere. So serving people wholeheartedly is also a way to weaken that habit. If we know that they interfere, then do it. Do it wholeheartedly. Why? Because now we know, why is habit strong? Because of the ego. And so when I go the other way, to serve holy men wholeheartedly, or a holy whatever, then I'm going to weaken habit. I'm going to discover habit and weaken habit. Selfishness interferes in many, many subtle ways as personal interests come up at one time or another. So in serving the holy man or whatever, and today, especially in society, there is a disdain for all of this. What have they done? What if anything else? Why should I put myself below them and do this? Why can't it all be plain Jane and everything be equal and things of that kind? My friends, the more you try and do that, the more less you will see the things that are better, the things that are good, the things that are truly worth aspiring, because you level the playing field. When you level the playing field, you burn aspiration completely. Aspiration in the material, this, that, or the other, but not in the spiritual, not in the heart. That is the opposite of growth. And my friends, that is dangerous and should be let go. So in serving those who have trodden the path before them, you serve your aspiration. And this has to be very clear. Ultimately, in doing good for the others, you do good to yourself, because goodness increases in you. Goodness resides in you. Goodness flourishes in you. In serving and in doing good to others, you must have goodness to do good to others. When you do good to others, you increase your goodness. It's a very beautiful thing. You know, I have a little story to tell you about a long time back. I was in a place, I won't say where and when, a long time back, many, many years back, giving a talk, and there was a children's group that had gathered for some sort of summer camp type gathering. A whole bunch of children. I was asked, can you speak to them? There's about 150 of them or something like that. And we gathered all, and first they had, you know, wanted everybody to sit in a sort of organized manner and all that. And I said, no need for all of that. Just let them come and sit wherever they, feel comfortable, and no need to organize it too much. Let them be natural a little bit. And so we sat, and instead of doing a long talk with them, I asked them a few things. And I said, well, does anybody have any question at all that they would like to ask? And there was a little girl in the audience. She must have been about 5. And she asked, Swamiji, why is it good to be good? My friends, there was pin drop silence in that gathering. And there were parents on the outside, children between the ages of maybe 4 or 5 and maybe 16 or 17. And their parents were in the outer perimeter. There was pin drop silence, with probably some heads going down, and a little girl asking a very profound question. And so I asked her to come closer and sit close by, and said, we'll discuss it. And so it took some time, talking about 10 or 15 minutes that day. And basically, the theme of it was this: goodness is its own reward. You don't do good things for something else. Goodness has a value of itself. When you are good, goodness increases, and that has a value of itself. Of course, I said this in a sort of easy to understand, simple and slow way, but it's very interesting. So in serving others, we serve our own aspiration. This is the point that I was trying to drive home. This, my friends, is surgery on the ego. And Swami Shivananda used to call this type of surgery egodectomy. Very interesting. Of finding a way to serve selflessly is finding a way to get rid of selfishness, or to be selfless. What a wonderful thing. Selfless service purifies the heart and mind. As the seeker searches the scriptures for self-knowledge and studies them, you need a clean or pure heart or mind for those teachings to get through. And so service paves the way. it by purifying the heart and mind, then study becomes meaningful. And what is meaningful study? Meaningful study is that when you come to a teaching, the teaching can bring about real change in yourself. How many times have we come upon these teachings, but we've still been the same way? We've gone and heard all of these things, but we're the same way. They still sound wonderful, but we're the same way. Why haven't the teachings become us? Just like food, my friends, if you want it to nourish you, you've got to eat it. The food has got to become flesh. So if you want the teachings to benefit you, you've got to eat it. It has got to become flesh. The teaching has got to become you. It is as simple as that. So this is why purity of heart and mind is essential. And all these things that we are talking about are so essential because they are at the very core of real spirituality. It is then that we can search the scriptures and all of the teachings and everything else, and it can make sense to us. Study is meaningless unless there is purity of heart and mind. It is meaningless. It's not going to bring that about. And so there are many different ways to bring that about. It is difficult, my friends, to plunge yourself into meaningful study with the ego lurking in the shadows, because we are not studying the scripture, but through the scripture, we are studying ourselves. This is something to keep in mind. We never study the scripture. Through the scripture, we study ourselves. This study leads to self-inquiry, or to inquiry naturally. And the seeker begins to inquire into things. It brings about real, meaningful change. When the seeker comes to this state, the seeker is said to have been established in the first state of yoga. All that we have talked about till now is that first state of yoga called Shubhicha, which is an auspicious or a noble wish. This noble wish has got all these things that we have talked about today. Okay, my friends, today we've covered the first of seven states or planes of wisdom of the great sage Vasishtha. And in that, we took up Shubhicha. Shubhicha is a noble wish. And we may think at the outside that we know what a noble wish is. I think for good things. But today we have seen that it is a whole lot more than merely thinking of another good thing. Shubhicha involves all these: awakening, renunciate, renunciation, behavior of a renunciate, and the focus of a renunciate. Next time, we continue with the seven states or planes of wisdom by discussing the second state, vicharana, or direct and steady observation of the mind. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or a PDF handout, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.